You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Ed Song, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College out in Santa Barbara, California. Also joining us today is Nick Rodriguez. Nick is originally from Southern California, a graduate of Stanford, a Marshall Scholar at Oxford in the London School of Economics, and works as a policy expert in education system reform. Nick lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife, Winsa, and his son, where he attends Anacostia River Church. Now, I said that Nick is an expert in education policy, but that's not actually what we're going to be talking about today. We're talking about an article that he wrote for the Gospel Coalition encouraging Christian leaders to encourage their congregations, their followers, to vote for Hillary Clinton. So, Nick, Ed, how are you guys doing today?
I'm doing all right. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you with us, Nick.
Thanks.
And so we have the whole country represented, right? East Coast, middle part of the country, West Coast.
That's right.
So it's whatever we decide on should be representative of the American people, right?
If
we
can just agree on something. Everyone.
So Nick, you've written pretty substantially about this, not necessarily in terms of a large number of online articles, but fairly long, fairly thoughtful ones, both for the Gospel Coalition and on your own blog, which is and you should just tell us, 'cause I'm going to get the title wrong.
It's called Now Till November, and it has exactly one entry on it, and it's just nowtillnovember.wordpress.com.
Right. Does that mean that's going to be the only entry until November, or?
Actually, no. I'm thinking of writing one or two more, but the idea was to actually just write from now till November, because it was one of those things where I woke up one morning and I thought, this guy Trump could actually win this election. That's enough to get me out of bed and want to do something about it. And so to the extent I can have a disproportionate impact on the election, maybe this is a way I can do it. So that literally the idea from the blog came from that.
But come December, you're going to close the doors.
Most likely, yes. It'll be, if nothing else, with the kind of 50 readers that I have, it'll be a face-saving way to say I've achieved victory and I'm now going to shut down the blog.
Sure. A significant portion of that blog, that one entry, is dedicated to kind of explaining how you got to where you're at politically.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about that? So what's your background both in the faith and kind of where you're coming from in terms of your political ideology?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Southern California, and I think that, my political views were shaped like kind of any person's might be by the people around me, a little bit by my family. So my parents are actually both, Republicans, and they kind of raised me as a good Republican. And then at some point, I sort of became that sophomoric teenager adolescent who said, I'm going to do it differently, and started to kind of take on some progressive views about a number of things. And actually, the fact that I work in education policy, I distinctly remember being about 5 years old and moving from Los Angeles to the suburbs, asking my parents why, and them saying, well, we want you to go to a better school. And sort of wondering about the agency my parents had to do that and to sort of, seek a better education for me, where a lot of other people, might not have that opportunity. And so that started me down a long road towards, I think, a set of progressive principles around equal opportunity and the work I do today. I think that... So fast forward to my kind of college years. I'm kind of politically active, interested in all this stuff, but not a Christian. And a series of circumstances lead me in graduate school to become a believer. And I think that what was most interesting about that was that I was in graduate school in the UK, as you mentioned, Coyle. And I like to say that the Lord must have taken me out of the country specifically so I could become a believer. Because I'm pretty sure my heart was pretty hard to the gospel as I understood it in America, right? Because, you could be forgiven as a non-Christian for believing that Christian and political conservative are one and the same thing. And that was certainly what I thought. And so it was a new world for me to go to London and to meet kind of evangelical Christians who voted Labour, who voted Conservative, who voted Liberal Democrat, or whatever the, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of party was, and to realize that it didn't have to be that way. And that was what allowed me to hear sort of the unvarnished gospel. So I become a believer, but I still have all these progressive beliefs. And I start picking them apart one by one, and I say, well, I have to at least consider that my American friends are right about this. Maybe there's a reason all these Christians are Republicans, right? And so I start asking, well, which of these beliefs does the Bible kind of require that I change? And there were a few, and I changed them. But for the most part, and I write about that on the blog, right, the main one being abortion. And that was a bit of a journey for me, but I sort of eventually got there. And I think that, but meanwhile, most of the rest of the kind of principles that I had embraced as a younger person held. I saw no biblical reason to kind of abandon the other things that I'd come to believe in. And so I find myself today kind of a pro-life progressive Democrat, as Ed helpfully gave me the label.
Yeah, brother, there are at least two of us.
That's right, there's at least two of us on the planet. We are somewhat politically homeless, but here we are.
Well, and you both went to college and got converted, right? Which is very, very contrary to the standard narrative of college is a place where you lose your faith.
Yeah, but at secular places.
Very secular places.
It's not like we went to Liberty or Southwest Baptist University in Ball River, Missouri.
We are not a very secular place, and we're proudly not very secular. But that's a different conversation. So to get into some of the substance of your article, I guess, Nick, you encourage Christian leaders to encourage their congregations, their followers. I'm assuming you don't mean from the pulpit, right?
Yes, thank you for asking that question. And I realized I should have been more careful in writing that, because I really did just mean encouragement generally. I think the pulpit, I think we'd all agree, is a, you know, what was it, one pastor once? It was Michael Lawrence who said to me, you know, the pulpit is where you are in sin if you're not there on Sunday, and therefore we must be very careful to keep the pulpit a place for the gospel, right? And for really kind of sticking to the gospel. I absolutely agree with that. You want to know what actually motivated me to frame it that way, as opposed to simply saying, like, I'm a believer who wants to support Clinton. I said, evangelical leader, you should tell us to support Clinton. It was because I was listening. It was funny. I was listening to Al Mohler's podcast, right? So the briefing comes out every day. And I hear him talking about the election. This is several months ago. And he keeps on talking about how, I mean, you know, Trump's bad. Wow, that's a problem. But then he turns around and in this sort of kind of false equivalent sort of way sort of says, and the evolution of the Democratic Party is just as concerning, effectively, right? Because Bernie is gaining some traction, because, you know, and I'm sort of like, I think this is where most kind of evangelicals who comment on politics the way Al is in his podcast are kind of thinking about it, sort of a pox on both your houses, these guys are both equally awful, when in fact, you know, in my mind, it doesn't strike me that Hillary Clinton is that different from Barack Obama or from Bill Clinton, you know, or from any other number of kind of conventional Democrats that there are out there. So I felt like it was a bit of a false equivalence. And if you want to make the argument, oh, Bernie really dragged her to the left, yeah, a minimum wage from $12 to $15 an hour and opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's pretty much all you can point to concretely in terms of the impact Bernie had on the election. So it's weird to me to see people equate sort of what happened in the Democratic Party with what happened in the Republican Party this primary season. And so I thought, well, I can go make this argument, but no one's going to believe me. I'm a, until recently, sort of straight-ticket Democratic voter who is also a person of color and an evangelical Christian. No one's going to listen to me. But if someone like Al Mohler were to say something like this, they'd probably listen to him. So that was actually literally the construct in my mind as I decided to frame the post that way.
And that's maybe a good place to get into some of the substance of it. So to ask this kind of confrontationally, why should Christian leaders encourage their congregations to vote for the party that cheered abortion and gay marriage at its national convention? Yes.
Well, Coyle, I could just as easily ask, why should an evangelical Christian vote for the party that cheers racism and xenophobia at its national convention?
And we will be asking that question.
But I guess my point, the point I'd broadly make about that is that we don't have the luxury of thinking in absolute terms when it comes to who we vote for. right? Like, that's actually true. That's actually been true of every election ever in the history of mankind, but it's in particularly sharp relief this time, isn't it? As we see, like, that there are, in both cases, the parties are cheering things that are fundamentally unbiblical. So, I said that just to note that it's a question of which alternative is better. And so, go back to your question, why vote for a party that does those admittedly bad things? Because it's better than the alternative. The alternative, as I argued in the post in a couple of different ways, really has the potential to dismantle the very democratic system that allows you to even contest the questions of abortion and gay marriage in a free and democratic way. And so to me, I see Trump as a threat to that very system. And for that reason, kind of everything else is sort of off to the side as I try to figure out how to get rid of that threat before we can get back to kind of our regularly scheduled programming when it comes to political debate.
And I don't, again, I don't, I'm no supporter of Trump. I don't think you'll really find us defending him on the podcast. So in, even if I grant, you know, that, yeah, he is perhaps as a threat to the Republic, the response that you're going to get from presumably Al Mohler, although I would not claim to speak for him individually, but the response you're going to get is that, look, Hillary has done things that are just as much a threat to democratic principles, everything from the way she handles, you know, classified documents to the shenanigans going on behind the scenes in the Democratic Party that tank Bernie Sanders' campaign to, I mean, we could go through the list of the ways in which she has intentionally or otherwise subverted democratic processes. Why is he the bigger threat? Again, why can't we just say a pox on both of them? They're both undermining the Republic.
Absolutely. No, it's a great question. And I think, to me, this is the key question, right? Are the differences in the flaws, are the differences between the flaws of Trump and the flaws of Clinton differences of degree or differences of kind? And my emphatic argument is that they are differences of kind, right? So I literally, if you line up every other person who ran for president this term, this season, on a left to right spectrum, from sort of Bernie Sanders on the very, very left to Ted Cruz on the very, very right, I would tell you that all of them fall into the category for me of acceptable conventional politicians, right? And I don't agree with Ted Cruz on almost anything, right? And there's a lot I don't like about Bernie Sanders either. So think of that as a left-right spectrum. And then there's another vertical spectrum, which I call not crazy and crazy. And Trump's the only guy who actually is on a different position on that spectrum from everybody else. He is the type of person who, quite frankly, overtly defies norms, right? So just a couple of examples of this. When he says he's going to order soldiers to torture the families of terrorists, that's one thing. I mean, you could chalk that up to ignorance. They then come back and say, well, you know, that's against international law and the soldiers won't obey that order. And he says, oh, they'll obey me. Right? So that is deeply troubling. That is not anywhere on even close to the level of trying to hide some stuff in your emails. Okay? It's not even in the same category. So he's basically advocating for a war crime and saying he will make it happen. Right? I mean, there's a story, right, in history, Coyle, which you're probably aware of, probably apocryphal, right? But it's a useful illustration when the Supreme Court rules against Andrew Jackson on the trail of tears. You know, what is he supposed to have said? He's supposed to have said, Mr. Justice Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. And as Commander-in-Chief of the Army, he personally goes and leads the force that evacuates the Native Americans from Georgia and participates in what people today would call a genocide, right? And, you know, thankfully the Republic survived that. But that's literally a person in charge of the most powerful of the three branches of government choosing to ignore what the other two say, right? And say what you will about Hillary Clinton, if she had been indicted, she would have stood trial, right? If she were president and she were impeached and removed, she would have left office. Like, Hillary Clinton's, like, sins are all about, fit into the typical pattern of what a conventional sinful politician would do, which is doing everything you can get away with until you're boxed in by the checks and balances of the rest of the system. Trump doesn't operate like that, right? Trump just says, you know, the soldiers will do what I tell them. If I don't get my way, I'm going to make sure I get my way. He is more Andrew Jackson like he is like Hillary Clinton in that regard. And, you know, and I could go on and on and on about that. We're not going to honor our NATO treaty commitments. If Hillary wins the election, it'll be because it was rigged. You know, essentially the guy's a narcissist and an egomaniac, and that's the stuff dictators are made of. And so then going back to why he's a unique threat, I think what people don't appreciate enough about this country and its constitution is that our kind of resilience as a republic isn't based on the sort of genius of the written document of the constitution. I mean, there are a bunch of constitutions in Latin America that are like closely modeled on ours that haven't, you know, yielded nearly the same result, right? Our constitutional system is a product of norms and respect for them. And Trump uniquely is just sort of willing to overtly, brazenly, in front of everybody, flout those norms. And that's why I think the difference between Trump and Clinton is a difference of kind rather than degree.
Mm. Right. And I guess I would respond with the difference is the same. It's just where is it happening in public versus behind the scenes. So I don't know that Hillary has any more respect for the law than Donald Trump does. But again, like, she's a normal politician. She knows that you're not supposed to say that publicly.
And she's capable of being ashamed. Right? Like,
well,
in the court of public.
When she gets caught.
Well, that's the point, though. If Trump were to get caught, right? When Trump gets caught, he just says, I didn't do it. And he is able to do that with a straight face.
Or right. I did it, and I'm glad I did it.
Right. Exactly. Like, I mean, there's another example I give with a different person. So there are people who are conservatives who say that, you know, Obama equally has no respect for the law. I mean, look at his executive actions and look at this and look at that. But let me tell you something. When the Supreme Court ruled that the Medicaid expansion in Obamacare was unconstitutional, what did he do? He didn't say, Mr. Justice Roberts has made his decision, now let him enforce it. He abided by that ruling, right? And now, as a result, we have some states that took the Medicaid expansion and some states that didn't. When he did his whole deferred action thing for illegal immigrants, and that was struck down by the Supreme Court, he honored that decision, even though, you know, he could have just sort of unilaterally said, I'm just going to ignore it. And technically, who could have stopped him, right? Imagine Trump in that situation. He says, you know what? This is what I want. I'm going to do it anyway. And he'll just keep doing it, and who's going to stop him? He's the guy who commands the army. He's the guy who commands the executive branch. What you see in Obama is kind of, I'll do everything I can get away with until I'm struck down or slapped on the hand by someone else, and then I will retreat. The vast majority of political leaders behave like that, and Trump doesn't, and that's the problem.
I agree with everything that you just said, Nick, in the way that you put your point. Can I – so here's here's a kind of a supposed justification for voting for Trump. And the funny thing is here, like – so I'm the progressive. Coyle is the conservative. There's a way in which, while, you know, I think that Trump is a uniquely dangerous presidential candidate, there's a way in which I think I sort of understand why somebody would vote for Trump, like, more than Coyle does in some ways.
Well, I understand. You sympathize with that.
Sympathize is a strong word. If we can find something between understand and sympathize, right? But this is sure. But this is what it's going to look like for a lot of evangelical Christians. Yes, the things that he says are deplorable. Yes.
I like how you use that word.
Deplorable seems to be the word of the week.
Right.
Basket of deplorables.
That's right.
But he's a kind of an entertainer. He says things on the fly without sort of really thinking about the consequences. Mm-hmm. Were he to become president, then he would be hemmed in by all of the sorts of institutional things that are going on. Presidents don't just wave magic wands and things happen. You know, they happen because of the machinery of government. He's going to be surrounded by a staff. We'll sort of get around to I want to go back around to the abortion issue in a little bit. A further argument, he isn't even really interested in being president. There are lots of reasons to think that he's going to be sort of more of a kind of figurehead person in office. There's those interesting stories about, you know, when he was selecting his vice presidential candidate about how he sort of expressed to people, look, I'm not really interested in doing this. The vice president's going to do all the work anyway.
Right.
He's going to be a kind of a de facto figurehead. But in any case, one thing that he is going to do is he's going to appoint – there's a lot more reason to think that he's going to appoint, say, the kinds of conservative justices who conservatives care about.
Yeah.
I think of the evangelicals I know who are sort of – who are going to vote for Trump.
Yeah.
I think that's a little bit what their reasoning looks like.
Absolutely. I mean, you want me to say a little bit about that?
Yeah. So how would you respond to that kind of an argument?
Yeah. So first of all, let's just start with the fact that, like, Trump is deeply and cynically aware of this, right? Like, he's actually on record saying, yeah, the evangelicals are going to vote. Of course you're going to vote for Erie. And I can tell you exactly why. And he says, justices of the Supreme Court. It's almost like he's taunting the evangelical base, right? Almost daring them to oppose him. But first of all, that tells you something about kind of what sort of comrade in arms he is and what it means to jump into bed with him at all. Secondly, I would say it's not clear to me that Trump, I mean, again, Trump's the guy who has to actually make the nominations. And when push comes to shove, you know, what kind of Supreme Court justice is he going to pick? The kind that's going to sort of...
It's going to be his sister.
Potentially, right? Yeah, exactly.
I can't believe anyone actually thinks it's going to be anyone else.
Well, actually, but that...
I don't think it's going to be his sister.
Did you see the Republican convention ad? Who was on stage?
I mean, I think that's too crazy.
But actually, no, Coyle, you've just actually unearthed a really important truth, right? So, faced between the choice of a pliant kind of checks all the Federalist Society boxes, conservative justice, and a justice who will provide a vote that will, you know, dismiss the suit against Trump University, who is he going to pick? Right? Like, you've already seen the way he thinks about judicial interference and the way that he talks about, you know, like Gonzalo Curiel, for example. And by the way, think of it that way. He's going to go and try and overreach in an executive way in any number of ways, whether that's silencing the press, which he has also promised to do, sort of ordering soldiers to commit war crimes, you name it. He'll get sued. Those suits will inevitably be complicated enough that some of them will make their way to the Supreme Court. Then who's Trump going to appoint to the Supreme Court? Right? Like, so I just, given the kind of man he is, I'm not sure you can trust him as far as you can throw him, which is not very far. You know, when it comes to the promises he makes on that. Now, okay, so put that aside for a second. Assume he keeps those promises. Assume he just goes down the Federalist Society list, right, where he appoints, you know, his sister or whatever else, and she's got the right credentials as well. And these are all kind of pro-life stalwarts. They look for the first opportunity they have to overturn Roe v. Wade. So actually, let me back up from that. I'm going to talk about abortion in a second, and I'm only going to talk about abortion because in my mind, the only biblical reason we have for going for the Federalist Society list of judges is abortion. There is no other, right? And I know that's a bit of a radical statement to make, but a couple things, right? You know, gay marriage is sort of a close second, but the truth is, like, we're not talking about millions of people dying when it comes to gay marriage. We are talking about kind of a nice to have. And in a pluralistic society, it just doesn't strike me that Christians can expect to have a right to have marriage defined their way. Like, it's just we're a minority. Like, I'm not surprised that's the direction we're going, right? And then if you look at other stuff, like, those are all nice to haves. Abortion's a different issue because it's about defending lots and lots of lives. And that's, for me, what makes it different. So anyway, and then when you talk about kind of textualism and constitutionalism, there's a fallacy I think a lot of Christians have. And Coyle, I wonder if you'd agree with this, which is I think Christians often are drawn to the idea of textual originalists because we read our Bibles that way, and so we think the Constitution ought to be read that way, and that's an absolutely crazy notion, right? The Bible is completely different. It is all-sufficient. It is the inspired word of God. The Constitution is a political compromise worked out between a bunch of sinful people, many of whom were slave owners, right? That was deliberately left vague in lots of places precisely because of those political compromises. It's not surprising to me that kind of textualism doesn't always get us all the way to where we need to go. So to me, those other arguments for conservative Supreme Court justices, you can hold them if you like, but it's just not clear to me that there's a biblical basis for holding them, right?
Right. And I would agree that there's no biblical basis. So I would say it's the right position to hold.
For other reasons, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you should read words according to what they mean. And, you know, I mean, there are good reasons to be a textualist.
Yeah.
But,
absolutely.
Yeah, I think you can not be a textualist and still be a perfectly consistent Christian.
Right, exactly. Okay, so let's get back to the one sort of issue, which is to say the Supreme Court is the thing holding back kind of restrictions on abortion because of Roe v. Wade, right? So in theory, yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean,
Roe v. Wade goes away. It just goes back to the states.
That's right. That's right. My point is that nothing else is possible until the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. So I get why Christians think it's such an important issue, right? But in my post, I actually sort of say, hey, we'll play this forward for a second. Imagine the best case scenario. You get two or three more Scalia-like justices on the court. They immediately overturn Roe v. Wade. Right, it goes to the states, or better yet, Coyle, it goes to Congress. A supermajority in a Republican Congress just imposes a federal, nationwide ban on abortion. right? Which they can do. If Roe v. Wade is
I'm a states' rights guy, so I'd say none of them need to go to the states.
But the thing is, Quill, in your world of it, then you're going to have 25 abortion states and 25 non-abortion states, and that's actually going to. I mean, that's
sort of 1972 again, right?
Right. And so
sure.
So again, just look at the consequences of that. If you have 25 abortion states and 25 non-abortion states, what's going to happen? A whole intricate market is going to rise up for provision of abortion services across state lines, and for like there'll be abortion bus tours, just like there are marijuana bus tours into Colorado, the way there are now. Right? You won't see the industry will just change. It won't actually protect any unborn lives. Now, go for the stronger version of that, a federal ban, right? And that's where I kind of, there's additional evidence that I cite in my article there, which is to say that, you know, how many unborn lives do you actually end up saving, right? Look at the evidence around the world. There are lots of countries that ban abortion the way that we would like to ban abortion. And the abortion rates, if anything, are higher. In most cases, they are not lower. And here in North America and Europe, they're actually at kind of historic lows since we've started to measure. No thanks to abortion restrictions, mostly thanks to contraception and other types of things that progressives champion, but that conservatives won't touch with a 10-foot pole. So the sentence I use in my article, I say, is when you vote pro-life, do you want your vote to make a difference or a statement? Right? And so, like, as far as I'm concerned, the people who have done, you know, there are actually a lot of progressives who have done more, intentionally or not, right, to kind of prevent the killing of the unborn than most conservatives have. I think you could, now, suppose you follow this argument to its logical conclusion, you could actually argue that the mistaken Trumpian position of punishing the mother, right, which nobody wanted to touch, is actually the only way you would make abortion policy work in that regard. But that's not on the table. No one's putting that on the table. So I fundamentally question, like, the efficacy of what is contemplated by the pro-life movement in order to protect the unborn. And so to me, it's not just so clear-cut that, oh, he's going to appoint a conservative Supreme Court justice. It's not like he does that and magically tomorrow 6 million lives, you know, a million lives a year are no longer lost. It strikes me that the marginal impact of that will be much, much, much smaller, which is why I'm much less interested in that set of solutions.
And that I think that mentality is starting to change as we get farther and farther away from having people who remember, you know, 1972. Mm-hmm. Up until recently, I think the default setting was we get rid of Roe, we go back to the pre-1973 setting. Where you know people know that there were abortions that were going on. It wasn't a million and a half a year. So I think the assumption was there would still be abortion, but it would be much more restricted than it was. Now, of course, travel is easier today.
Yeah.
So going to the next state is much easier than it used to be to get an abortion. And people are in the mentality of I should be able to do this thing. This person is standing in my way, and I can execute them. So why shouldn't I be able to do that? You know, no one's going to complain but me. So I think the American psyche probably has changed in some ways that would mean the numbers don't automatically drop to, you know, pre-Roe numbers, which were pretty low. I mean, they
Well, and let me come back to that, because I have to say my whole kind of stance and decision to sort of start really being aggressively pro-life has come in recent years. I now am a father, right? Like, I have a 3-year-old at home. It's become really, really important to me, and I am just as horrified and terrified, right, by the kind of Holocaust that's going on under our noses. I think where I part ways with a lot of conservatives is, number one, in my sense of what will empirically actually help the situation, right? So, like, I mean, again, contraception, subsidies for mothers, kind of more supports that are going to allow people to sort of not contemplate abortion. I think there's a lot that can be done in that area that's really not being discussed. But number two, I think that the other thing that where I part ways with conservatives is just in, like, even the kind of the tone and the rhetoric, right? Like, I've never, like you know, so okay, people who commit abortions are sinners, and I have never seen sinners treated with less grace by Christians than I have in the way that I've seen people talk about those who support abortion or those who have had abortions or anything else like that. And I just think it's a terrible witness on our part as far as how do we actually minister to people who are dealing with and struggling with this kind of sin. So in both of those ways, I think I part with my friends on the right.
Yeah, and I think it's helpful to be able to talk to people who've worked in, you know, places like Alpha House, where you're actually working with the people who are thinking about abortion, to sort of get that language of grace down, or to think about, you know, think of my own sin and how do I talk about that, which also you have to balance it with speaking about the moral horror that goes along with it too. Yeah. So, you know, how do you truck that politically?
Absolutely. And it's tough to do. Absolutely would agree that it's tough to do. I understand why you want to have some righteous anger about it. I totally do. But it does strike me that the rhetoric seems unhelpful in a lot of places. Yeah. Anyway, we kind of got off the topic.
Yeah, I was going to say, where were we going with this?
But that was from the Supreme Court. Back to the original point, which is to say, I just feel as if we need to question this idea that sort of Supreme Court justices, QED, vote for Trump, right? And what I'm trying to do is cast some doubt on the kind of on how ironclad that logic actually is.
Well, if that's sort of Ed's sympathy or understanding, whichever the right phrase is, of the Trump voters, my kind of moment of softness, I guess, for lack of a better phrase,
moment of weakness,
voters, Coyle. Yeah, it might be. Is religious freedom the argument that Trump will do less active damage to religious freedom than Hillary will? If Hillary wins, which it still looks like she's going to, Hillary wins, I wouldn't be surprised in the next 4 years if the institution I work at has to decide between staying in existence and allowing, you know, homosexual students married student housing. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the local church that I attend is subject to a lawsuit because the pastor won't, you know, marry a gay couple. And with sort of the full support of the administration. Now, I think Trump is very pro-gay marriage, so I don't think that's really in the table. But I also don't think he cares about it. So
I get you.
I'm less worried that Trump will go out of his way to make things difficult for people who believe in religious freedom.
Yeah.
How do you respond to people who bring that up? And again, I don't think that's a good enough reason to vote for Trump, but that is one that I hear a lot.
Yeah. No. And actually, I think you're right. I think Trump's views on this are a little mysterious. You get the sense maybe he'll dance with the girl that brung him, and therefore, you know, he'll sort of do what his evangelical friends tell him to do, and perhaps that'll be a good thing for us. So it's interesting. Coyle, I think I'm troubled by this issue, too. I'm troubled by the direction of the Democratic Party on it. I can't help but think that if there were more Democratic progressives like me, that we could have an intra-party argument that people would actually listen to, right? Mm-hmm. When it comes to, because right now there are no evangelical voices, like or few evangelical voices on the left who kind of talk about the importance of this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I think about that a lot because I do feel as if I'd love to stand up and make that argument, say you have to draw the line in certain places. So for example, with gay marriage, I say, it's allowed throughout the country. Where I would draw the line is don't force churches to sort of perform marriages that are against their beliefs. I believe that is a right kind of definition of the separation of church and state. To your point, it's not clear to me that line will be respected, right, by future progressive democratic administrations, and I'm troubled by that. I wish I could bring, you know, me and Ed and a bunch of other people could sort of become an active force to make that argument. But as long as Christians are viewed as kind of in the bag for the Republican Party, it doesn't strike me as likely that that argument can be had. I feel as if that's an argument that you could make that you couldn't make as easily on abortion or on the other things, right? So that's kind of just one thing I want to point out. But I think there's a broader point here to raise about religious freedom, Quill, because I think that sometimes we as Christians conflate the idea of religious freedom with kind of the path of least resistance for Christians specifically. And I think that, and sometimes hard to tell the two apart, right? But I think the question I have for people who advocate for religious freedom is, are you as interested in defending, like, France's, you know, like, in sort of fighting against France's burkini ban as you are in protecting the right of, kind of a university to kind of practice employment practices that are consistent with its spiritual beliefs, right? Go take it to Trump for a second and to the conservative movement more generally, right? Are you as interested in protecting the rights of people of all faiths to immigrate to this country, right, as you are in the rights of, like, florists to kind of do business as their conscience dictates with whom their conscience dictates, right? And I think that the problem I have is that I think – so because the Progressive Party has pluralistic instincts – on the basis of pluralistic priors, you can make the argument, guys, you've got to carve out the exception here, you've got to do this, you've got to have these walls. I think they'd be receptive to that argument. I think that for the vast majority of non-Christian conservatives who are sort of in alliance on this, what you're seeing is actually the conflation. It's more like, let's impose values we feel comfortable with on everybody else and call it religious freedom. And to me, that's unsustainable. Christians, as we know them, are a minority. They will probably be more of a minority 20 years from now than they are now. The reason I want to stand up for the Muslims' right and for the Hindus' right is because I know that one day I'm going to need them to stand up for mine as well. To me, that's the only sustainable definition of religious freedom. Its only plausible home is the Democratic Party, but right now nobody is making that argument. And I'll be the first to say I'd want to be one of the guys making that argument because I do think it's really important.
And I'm not in touch enough with the modern Republican Party to know what their general stance is. The circles that I sort of pay attention to tend to be very, look, First Amendment rights are First Amendment rights, yeah, regardless of whether you're Christian or Muslim or what have you.
I think the actual kind of Christians, I mean, look at like the ERLC and Russell Moore, right? Like, right, they're doing stuff that's on behalf of, they make common cause with people of other faith groups, super duper important stuff. But right, then go to Trump and the Muslim ban.
Right.
Go to Ted Cruz and I think he probably is a believer, who says, let's not take in refugees except Christian refugees, right? I mean, talk about the opposite of religious freedom, right? And the kind of thing that's going to get you kind of punished extra when you're in the minority and someone in the majority is in a position to take advantage of you.
Right. And mm-hmm. and again, that's that is Republican institutions that I'm not as familiar with. So one of the people I do follow, the guy running for attorney general in the state of Missouri, was the attorney for the Hobby Lobby the Supreme Court Hobby Lobby case, was also loosely associated with the religious freedom question in Guantanamo Bay. You know, can you wear a beard and so on? Not that he was the lead attorney on that or anything, but again, there's association. So again, that tends to be more my side of things. I just don't know enough about the wider Republican Party. Based on Trump's win, I suspect you're right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think like when you look at the direction of the party and the extent to which like the Trump vote, like the stereotypical Trump voter, like the white working class kind of voter, and the extent to which like that's the future of the Republican Party, I don't know that there's a lot of reason to think that those concerns about religious freedom are sort of broad and universal and portable as opposed to my white Christian religious freedom.
Right. It's probably fair to say that the number of people who care about actual religious freedom in the full meaning of the term is fairly restricted.
Yeah.
I mean, evangelical and Christians and informed Catholics. And
yeah,
it's fair.
Not even all of either.
There are these interesting debates about, I mean, it'll be interesting to see sort of like how committed progressives are to sort of genuine religious freedoms and freedom of conscience when push comes to shove. I mean, I see the issue of gay marriage, I guess like you, maybe my view is even stronger than yours, but like for me, for reasons of like rights of equal treatment, I think as a matter of justice, you know, gay people should be able to get married. And I think in some ways it's important for evangelical Christians to sort of stand up for that right, in part, as you said earlier, so that when the shoe is on the other foot, as the shoe gets on the other foot, we can say, well, hey, you remember how I was with you on that? This is what it means to sort of be genuinely committed to.
That's right.
Rights and liberties.
And by the way,
you guys are way too generous to progressives.
Well, can I say though, Coyle, there are genuine divisions even in the gay rights movement on this. Right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So go read Andrew Sullivan, who is like the guy who invented the movement for gay marriage, right? Like, or at least he's credited with that. He'll be the first to tell you, guys, you are overreaching now. Yeah. Like, we don't need to be doing this. Like, there are potential allies out there who have, because ultimately, right now, so think of it this way. Right now, the Republican Party is the party of kind of imposing the sort of cultural Christian worldview. Right now, the Democratic Party is the party of imposing the secular worldview, right? But of the two parties, the party that is most likely to kind of be open to a message of religious freedom based on a pluralistic worldview is the Democratic Party. Like, I have very little doubt about that. But the argument needs to be made. And people, like I need to get comfortable. Evangelicals need to be comfortable being like, yeah, I'm going to make common cause with Andrew Sullivan to carve out exceptions and make sure that kind of each kind of religious group is able to sort of negotiate those difficult questions of how in a pluralistic society people with different worldviews engage together to make public policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one other avenue where you can see this similar kind of like free speech on college campuses is an issue in which progressives are like, you know, of two minds. And there are lots and lots of progressives who are really concerned about constraints on free speech, just as there are progressives, you know, who are expressing a lot of concern about the way in which speech is impinging upon the rights of minority students and things like that.
Right. That's right. I mean, if you want to know who's against campus PC culture, look at the remarks of President Obama, right? Look at the liberal columnist Jonathan Chait, right? Like, they are speaking out and getting a lot of flack, right, for saying, actually, guys, this is out of control, right? So it's so funny. Mm-hmm. You know, Republicans think they have a monopoly on being anti-PC. They do not, actually. Mm-hmm. And they've just redefined PC to, you know, to be equivalent to the word decent in the age of Trump.
Yeah, like Yale was in the news. I guess it was last year over the incident that broke out about in which students were sort of very hostile and critical of a particular faculty member. Mm-hmm. But like the Yale faculty, they were very exercised about that and were extremely concerned about free speech rights.
Exactly.
So that's certainly not an area in which progressives are of one mind.
Yeah, we've gone on a little bit of a tangent here. We should sort of redirect and put us back in focus. Nick, how do we interact with Christians who've come to the opposite conclusion? So how do you get along well, speak well with Christians who have decided that no, Trump really is the lesser evil, especially given how polarizing this election has become on society?
Yeah, the short answer is you have to deal with people who disagree with you with grace and with charity. I think that's just a bedrock fundamental principle when it comes to this sort of these sorts of disagreements. And you know how I feel about Trump, but I think when it comes to working with, and you know, I answered a couple of emails from people who disagreed with me when I made that original blog post, and I think it's just important that we handle ourselves with grace and charity. There's a story, Coyle. I think you were at CHBC when both of our former pastor Mark Dever made this point. Mark is always great at saying provocative things, and he said, I think there are former slave owners who are in heaven now. And what he meant by that was that there were people who had mistakenly interpreted the Bible to mean to condone slavery and had sort of practiced it fulsomely, who were convicted evangelical Christians and just got that horribly wrong. And because of grace, because of Christ's amazing and wonderful grace, are still in heaven today, right? And I think about that often when I think about how right I think I am and how wrong I could be. So everything I've just said, right, I could be wrong about. And I think I have to acknowledge that. And I think it's what I owe people who disagree with me in a debate with them. And I think, broadly speaking, there is not nearly enough of that. Like, one of the things I find most disturbing when I read Christian political writing on the election or on politics in general is how it is almost indistinguishable in tone from secular political writing. How there is not nary a whiff of grace or charity. There is more point scoring, the type of writing that is common on the internet. And so I would ask anybody who's kind of active in the world of Christian politics, look at the tone of your social media posts. Look at the way you use your words. Like, are you being charitable? Are you being gracious to those who disagree with you? And if you're not, why? What's your kind of end? Are you trying to shame other people or are you trying to minister to them? I think that's a really, really important distinction. So that's how I feel about that.
Yeah. And then, so sort of shifting over, and I would imagine your answer will be fairly similar here, but, what sorts of experiences have you had since you have come out, in favor of Hillary as an evangelical Christian? How do you engage with non-Christians who support Hillary or, you know, non-Christians who support Trump for that matter?
So it's funny. I sent some of my writings to some of my non-Christian friends, and they were all, it's funny, they were all interested in the argument. You can imagine that the Post had a lot for the average secular liberal to disagree with, right? The sort of everything that I said about abortion, everything I said about kind of biblical imperatives or anything else like that. One person said something interesting to me, though, which I think was probably the highest compliment I had received. She said, Nick, I feel as if for a brief moment I was led inside your echo chamber. And frankly, I imagine that rare is the written piece that actually does that, because most of us are just reading the stuff from our own echo chamber. So that's why I thought it was a particularly unique thing that I heard. I've tried to write in a way that a Christian obviously can pick it up and say, well, this is what it looks like inside the mind of a progressive Democrat who's pro-life, who's a Christian, so that so that hopefully conservatives could understand people like me better. But the opposite is true. For my kind of secular liberal friends to understand what is it like inside the head of somebody who shares a lot of your progressive values but holds them for completely different reasons, right? Who for example, is against racism not out of some abstract theory of the equality of man, but because I believe everybody is created in the image of God, and therefore that is a fundamental value that we have to protect. It's been nice to kind of have that sort of dialogue. So I feel as if I've actually gotten a chance to dialogue with both kind of Christian friends and non-Christian friends about this in a way that was helpful and informative and hopefully bore witness, at least in some cases, about kind of how my hope made being a believing evangelical a little less scary for people like me 13, 14 years ago who thought conservatism and, you know, evangelical Christianity were one and the same thing. When it comes to Christians who support Trump, or I'm sorry, just people who support Trump, I should say. So my father is one of those, actually. And Ed, actually, this goes back to the point you've made about sympathy. One of the things I notice whenever I watch Trump talk is actually how much he sounds like kind of my dad, kind of reasoning about the world. When he says stuff like, you know, what's going on in Syria? It's unbelievable what's going on there. We got to fix it. We're going to fix it. Right? That's literally like conversations around the dinner table or in the backyard for me growing up between my dad and kind of his sort of middle-aged conservative friends. And I think, again, grace and charity, like I think I try to recognize when there are sort of diminishing returns to my like kind of making an argument there. And in many cases, I think I just try to listen and to understand. And if I feel as if I could move the needle by saying something, then I do. But I am acutely aware that I don't know that many Trump voters. And that is actually a product of the kind of sorting and polarization and the fact that I live in the middle of a city, you know, and there's a whole swath of America and Americans that I'm not kind of connected to and aware of. I have to be respectful of that. And so when I actually meet a Trump voter, I think my posture to begin with will be one of listening.
Yeah, that's definitely been probably the biggest thing for me this election is how disconnected I have to be from the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up in a red state. My family is working class. I have sort of friends up and down the spectrum, social and economic, that are Republicans. And I can count on one hand the number of people I know who are excited about Donald Trump. Like, I know people who are sort of grudgingly going to, you know, swallow the bullet, bite the bullet and vote for him. But in terms of excitement, it's just not there.
Well, and the argument that I've been trying to make is, you know, and the reason I wrote that original post was that I think it's important. I think my message to Christians is, you know, he really is as bad as you fear he might be, or there's a strong possibility that he is. We have a spotty record as an evangelical community of being on the wrong side of history on a number of different kind of issues. I would love for that not to be the case here. Right? I would love, for the sake of the witness of the church, for us to be able to say we fought against this evil and we helped defeat it. And I think, too, that, again, with respect to people who feel differently, because they feel differently, and that, I mean, they think I'm voting for evil, so I get it, right? But I think that, for me, the argument is, hold your nose, vote for Clinton just this once. We can get back to the business of fighting over these really important other issues once we settle this broader issue that I think has implications for like the future and viability of our republic.
Ed, any follow-up?
No, I think that's probably as good a way to wrap up this conversation as we could possibly achieve.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast. We are proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. For more information about our own podcast or any of our other shows, please visit christianhumanist.org. We do have a number of reviews up on our iTunes page. Please drop in and give us some ratings, give us some reviews, preferably positive ones. You can check out our Facebook page as well at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. We occasionally get into it there as much as we do on the show, so please check that out. You can leave us messages there or contact us directly at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to Nick Rodriguez for joining us. Check out his blog and his writings on the election. And on behalf of Ed and Nick, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high.